Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on Kingston 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Today, joining me as co-host, we've got Mr. Mike Brown.
Bonjour.
Yeah, bonjourney.
Yes, exactly. It's so, one of those things.
Mr. Brown, boy, it's been a while again. You keep disappearing. Are you going? You're in hiding.
Well, I got things to do, Al. You know, I'm just
like your nails.
Actually, no. Every time I jump into the Facebook group to offer my services, somebody else has already taken all the shows. So, or at least the ones I want to be on.
Well, I wonder what's going on.
I don't know. I think you have a really good group of co-hosts now. So.
Yeah, you know, they it comes and goes, right? There's some
yeah.
Certainly some interesting people, but it's no, it's all good. And you're going to be doing CrimeCon. What other events are you got going?
Oh gosh, CrimeCon for sure. We're going to be there from April 29th to May 1st in Vegas with our own table on Podcast Row with the other true crime podcasters. So that's going to be quite fun. It has been in past years. I've been to Nashville and New Orleans before, but I've been to Vegas quite a few times already, so I'm really looking forward to returning and having some fun there. My co-host, new co-host Matthew, is going to be with me, so it'll be a good time.
Yeah. Maybe you'll become a regular. You'll be like taking Celine Dion's place.
Have my own Vegas show.
Have your own Vegas show. You never know.
She's
out sick. Yeah, she's out to cancel. So there you go. There's an opening.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to see me or hear me sing any of her music.
Just wear the same outfit and put on a hat. They won't know. You never know. You don't know.
Well,
until
I
you try.
Do know. Nobody wants to see that. I'm fairly certain.
Put on a CD and pretend.
lip sync like a drag queen.
Yeah, see, there you go. We're getting you all set here,
right?
Okay, now today we're talking to someone in Canada on the east side in the Toronto area, and he's a returning guest. This time he's got a new book out called The Beetle Bandit. So Mr. Nate Hendley, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me back, always a pleasure.
First of all, what got you into this story itself? Like how did it fall into your hands?
Well, this is a good example of networking in action. I was doing a presentation at a library about a totally different book, and this guy named Paul Truster approaches me, tells me he's a lawyer, that he's got a really good story for me. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay, whatever. Because as I'm sure you know, as a busy true crime writers, we get approached all the time by people with the greatest story ever. And it often turns out not to be, or they turn out to be a kook. So I met with Paul. He gave me his spiel. He had grown up in this neighborhood in North York, which is a suburb. It's now part of Toronto, but it was initially sort of its own thing. And he told me this story I'd never heard of, about this bizarre bank robber who robbed the bank in 1964 in North York. He was dubbed the Beetle Bandit. And he sort of almost casually mentioned that he'd been researching this for years and had a treasure trove of documents, like police documents. He had the entire court transcripts, like 1,000 pages. And, you know, this is just like, you know, as a crime writer, this is just catnip. These are all public documents. You can quote from them. So the more I delved into it, the more it sounded like a fascinating topic. And so I approached Gunder and Press. They really loved it. And a book was born out of that experience. So that's kind of the genesis of the whole thing. And to be perfectly honest, before Paul Truster approached me, I had never heard of this guy, Beetle Bandit, and I'd never heard of this particular crime.
I hadn't heard of it either, and I do Canadian crime exclusively. And when I saw your book, The Beetle Bandit, and you sent me a copy of it, and I've been through it, and I just like, what the heck? How did I not know about this really interesting story? In particular, the composite drawing.
Oh, yes, the notorious composite drawing. I guess we can get to that in a sec. But what astonished me is I discovered there's no one else had written a whole book about this guy, that there might have been little, you know, mentions in other books and stuff. But I thought, oh, yeah, okay, great topic. I'm sure there must be like a slew of books about this guy. Discovered, no, there isn't. I'm like, okay, so that's a nice opportunity. I love doing books about crime topics that aren't hugely well known.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way to do it. We've got enough Ted Bundy. yeah, but you know, I hadn't heard of it either, and I even looked through, and it's hard to find any information. Really, there's not like most of it's got your name attached to it when you go online.
Yeah, it's a very odd story because it was hugely covered in the media at the time. Like, in addition to Paul's research, I dug up a ton of old newspaper accounts about this crime, front page news, you know, it would happen in Toronto, so that's media capital. Front page news and all the local papers was on, you know, TV, you know, debates about this. And then it just sort of disappeared into this black hole. And I found that totally weird, but it sort of gave me great motivation. Sort of tell this story that almost no one has ever heard of.
What do you think it was that made it disappear? And because it is such an interesting and compelling thing, but just poof, gone away for all these years.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, Mike, I really don't know. And that in Canada, we seem to have this weird thing of forgetting our own historic past, but if you want to drill down, also forgetting our own criminal historic past. To jump ahead a bit, the Matthew Carey Smith Beetle Bandit was one of the last people in Canada sentenced to hang, and I mention that to people and they look at me and they go, oh, I didn't know Canada had capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, yeah, we did, from the time of Confederation, 1867, right up to 1962, they hanged over 700 people in Canada. That it used to be, if you were convicted of murder, you were almost automatically put to death. And that's another fact that has sort of disappeared into the black hole, that, you know, that Canada had capital punishment. And I don't honestly know, because the last book I did, The Boy and the Bicycle, which is about this wrongful murder conviction in Toronto in 1956, involving a 14-year-old, no one had ever heard of that one either. And again, big story at the time, disappeared. So I think it's maybe part of this overall Canadian amnesia that a lot of true crime tends to be dominated by American stories, you know, or British, you know, Jack Ripper, of course, you know, Charles Manson, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, all these stories tend to get a bit more play. And we forget we have our own bizarre and sometimes very sad horror stories back here in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't get the media coverage as well. We haven't got all the, you know, the Nancy Graces and stuff up here doing all these shows and
good point. And, yeah,
you know, beating to death. You know, they would talk about this 24/7 for, you know, weeks and follow the trial on CNN. And we don't.
There's something cultural, I think, about Canada, too, in the way we tell stories and the stories that are important to us. And some reason it feels like there's kind of a shame sometimes around our dark past, which makes my show quite easy to write and research because there's a lot of things that I can talk about that people just don't mention anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Like, in addition to the fact that Canada used to have the death penalty, there's all these other topics, you know, either crimes or like the fact that I discovered through the writing of this book that there were these bizarre regulations in Canada back in the 50s that made it quite easy to acquire semi-automatic rifles, which nowadays, of course, big controversy in Canada, semi-automatic military style rifles. Back in the 60s, Beetle Man had just walked into a gun store on the street and purchased this using gave a false name and, you know, just strolled out this FN rifle that the Canadian Armed Forces used a version of it. And that's another little sort of thing that a lot of people nowadays, when I mention that, they're like astonished. Oh, well, I didn't think we could sell guns in Canada. Like, yeah, there's certain, it's funny because Canadians complain all the time about other countries not understanding Canada and having myths about Canada, but Canadians are pretty bad too about not understanding their own history or accepting these weird myths, you know, that we were, you know, this peaceful society and never had any guns and no one ever was hanged. And it's just not true.
Yeah. I recently told the FLQ story on my podcast and people were shocked. Like, there was terrorism and bombings in Canada. It's like,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, there was a Ku Klux Klan in Canada that was active in the 20s. People are often astonished to hear that.
Let's talk a little bit about the story. What's the basic premise of the story so that people know what happened?
Okay, well, I will cut to the chase, then give a tiny bit of background so I don't, you know, bore you completely. July 24th, 1964, this young man, Matthew Carey Smith, and he's an intelligent guy, but deeply troubled, to, you know, use a generic expression, served in the Canadian Navy, but in the early 60s, he just starts robbing banks. And he has this idea that he's going to fund a one-man revolution against the government. It's a little hazy what he wants to do, but it just, like, he hates the government. So 1964, he drives up to Bathurst Manor, which is a neighborhood in Northwood near Toronto, puts on a disguise, which is like a Halloween mask of French President Charles de Gaulle and a beetle wig. You know, this is summer 64. Beetles are just everywhere, dominating the charts. They're going to play in Toronto in the fall. It's just like everywhere. So puts on this beetle wig, goes to this bank, a Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, takes a rifle out of a guitar case, and it's a Fabrique Nationale rifle, which is a military grade semi-automatic, fires around and gets everyone, you know, cows everyone and gets them to give him all this money. And at first it looks like, okay, this is like the third robbery he's done. Looks like he's going to get away with that. So he's leaving the bank and there's a bank patron there named Jack Blank. Mr. Blank is a veteran of both the Canadian Army and Israeli Army. And he's got, you know, military background, knows guns, and he's a bit of a hothead. At the time, here's another one of these little historical quirks. Banks in Canada stocked pistols, and the clerks were expected to use them in case of robbery. So Jack Blank knows this. One of the accountants from the bank, Carmen Lamp, goes into the bank, grabs a .38 caliber infilled revolver, Jack Blank wrestles it out of his hands. There's some debate about, Jack Blank's wife claimed that the accountant gave it to him. Everyone else says, no, Jack Blank grabbed it. Jack Blank runs after the Beetle Bandit, starts shooting at him. And the Beetle Bandit returns fire using a .45 caliber pistol at first. And Jack Blank is, pegging him. There's pegging, shots at him. And this is on this quiet suburban street, in Toronto. These things don't happen too often. Jack Blank, unfortunately, the revolver he was using only had 4 cartridges in it because the accountant, Carmen Lamb, had underloaded it because he was afraid it might drop on the floor and the hammer would hit a live round and go off. Now, before you say that sounds like paranoia, someone had actually been killed in a Toronto bank from exactly this accident, that a pistol had fallen to the floor and had discharged. So the gun only has 4 rounds. Jack doesn't know this. He shoots 4 shots. Beetle Bandit then picks up his rifle and kills him. Fires twice, hits him in the heart, hits him in the head. And so Jack Blank is dead. Beetle Bandit can't get his getaway car started. So he just starts wandering up the street. Police car suddenly shows up. Beetle Bandit turns, shoots up the police car, almost kills the officer. Meanwhile, a helpful civilian has commandeered a vehicle, comes up the street. I don't know what he was thinking of doing, maybe chasing the Beetle Bandit. Beetle Bandit sees this car coming. The guy in the car very wisely jumps out because he realizes this maniac with a gun who just shot a police car is looking at him. Beetle Bandit strolls to this vehicle, which the guy didn't bother taking the keys out of the ignition, throws his rifle in, throws his gun in, drives off, gets away with it. So for a period of almost 6 months, the Beetle Bandit is at large, and he acquires this nickname from the press because he's wearing a Beetle wig. So, of course, the Beetle Bandit, he's all over the news. And Jack Blank is hailed as a hero by his community and by a lot of newspapers saying, this guy's a warrior. He stood up. Starts a whole process of this debate, should he have intervened? Similar to the, nowadays there's this debate in the U.S. about armed vigilantes. Mm-hmm. Should they get involved in situations? So this happened in 1964, Canada. Here's an armed vigilante, tries to stop a bank robber, gets killed. Cops try to trace the rifle. They can't because the rifle wasn't registered. All these complicated things. And I'll just give a very quick thumbnail. January 1965, the Beetle Bandit is captured while driving up Yonge Street, which is the main thoroughfare in Toronto. He's with a companion, Matthew Amiot. He's taken to a police station, pistol falls out of his belt, and he just starts babbling and confessing. Oh yeah, I robbed this bank and killed this guy. And he starts giving this whole spiel about his revolution, and he's going to overthrow the Canadian government, and he admires communists. He throws some good words for Nazis, but he doesn't believe their ideology. He just likes the fact that they do violent things. Goes to trial, and it comes out that he had been diagnosed as schizophrenic. His mother was schizophrenic, and it became this whole complicated thing. It was more than just a little bank robbery where a guy got killed. It becomes an issue about gun control because there's all these issues. Newspapers saying, how come they can't trace this weapon? This is insane. Insanity defense because he pleads insane. Is he going to get off? And the death penalty because eventually he's found guilty and sentenced to hang. So 1965, the Beetle Bandit is sentenced to hang, and that commences a big campaign to try to save his life. There's a big effort to commute his sentence.
Was that in the community that they wanted to save his life? Like there was a people that just didn't want him to hang?
It was sort of in Canada at large. And the last hanging in Canada had been in 1962. Mm-hmm. So there had been an anti-death penalty movement growing for quite some time. Beetle Bandit's father, who's also named Matt Smith, campaigns to save his son's life. Like he acknowledges his son committed these crimes, but he said, my boy is mentally ill. He shouldn't be hanged. He gets a sympathetic ear from Scott Young, who's a journalist at the Globe and Mail, and father of Neil Young, future rock star. Scott Young is a big journalist at the time, and he does a lot of articles about, you know, you shouldn't hang this guy. He's obviously mentally ill. There's editorials across the whole country, actually. I collected a bunch of them, like Calgary, Vancouver, saying, you know, it's wrong to hang this guy. He's clearly mentally ill. And number two, as I said, there had been a lot of pressure to stop hangings in general at the time. So long and short of it, late 1965, the Canadian federal government announces that Beetle Bandit and two other guys who have been sentenced to death will not hang. Their sentences are commuted to life in jail. And this marked sort of, this was like the climax. This was after this, it was pretty obvious government was not going to let anyone else hang. So even though the law wasn't changed until 1976, there was a period of a few years where it was pretty obvious no one else in Canada was going to be hanged on the gallows, even if they were sentenced to death.
Right. What can you tell us about his family? Like, did he have a wife or children or anything going on at the time?
Yes. Well, he had this bizarre background. He was born in out west. His father was Matthew Bartley Smith. His mother was Helen Isabel Crichton. He had a sister, Leanne. He, you know, loving father, loving parents, but his mother developed mental problems very early on. Family split up. The father got custody of the kids. And the father had noted his son's eccentricities very early on. Like, he noted that Matt Smith was just, he seemed sort of in his own little world. He was, you know, just doing weird things. He expressed this huge admiration for bank robbers and wasn't really, you know, his life was just sort of turmoil. He's a very smart kid, but drops out of school, private school his dad had put him into. Joins the Navy and does okay for a while, but then asked to be released. He's at loose ends. He just starts 1960. He just starts robbing banks and stealing cars, robbing banks, no real purpose. And 1961, he's caught doing a car chase through Toronto, and he's diagnosed as part of his sentence. He's taken to a clinic. They diagnose him as schizophrenic. And his mother had also been diagnosed as schizophrenic. So he would sort of go from these weird kind of bizarre behavior to relatively normal. Like, he went out west, got a job with Inco, which is International Nickel. He's made a few friends, and he meets this wife while he's out west, Eileen Charity Amiot, was Métis. That means she's half Indigenous, half French. She agrees to come with him to Toronto, and he buys a house. He has these collection of people living with him, including, you know, his common-law wife. She moves her little daughter in at one point. Her brother is living there, a couple of buddies, and he's got guns everywhere. He buys all these guns. He's into revolution. So his wife remained loyal to him throughout all of this, and claimed that he was this, you know, great husband, common law husband, great guy, and was a terrific father to. She had a daughter from a previous marriage. And she claimed he was a great stepdad and all this sort of thing. So he did manage to have some relationships and a loyal partner for a long time. He fathered a child right before he went to jail. So I actually got a chance to speak to his son, Beetle Bandit's son, who's named Kerry Jr. And so that was an interesting experience. In some ways, he managed to lead a normal life. In some ways, it was the weirdest thing, because as one of the shrinks at the trial testified, being schizophrenic doesn't mean you're psychotic all the time. There's periods of lucidity, and Beetle Bandit could be fairly, I won't quite say rational, but he had enough sense to be able to buy a house and look after people. give his money out and stuff and work hard. Worked a machine as a machinist in a rubber plant, Dunlop Canada Limited, I think.
What was his point behind revolution? Like, what is it that he wanted to change? What was his revolution?
Well, here's the bizarre part is that he really didn't have an ideology, that he wanted to basically overthrow the Canadian government, but was always very vague on what he would replace it with. And he didn't want to make himself dictator. He sort of said, well, you know, we'll have a revolution and I'll become the chief of police or I'll head the army up. He basically would just rant and rave about how much he hated the government. And as far as can be discerned, he didn't have any specific ideology. I mean, I've read reports from the police where he would, you know, he's ranting and raving in the police station and they would take down every word. Nothing really logical comes out. It's just sort of, I hate the government. He did say they don't listen to young people, which is probably a legitimate point in 1964. Beyond that, like, it just this weird mishmash of nonsensical raving. He had this idea that he would herald a revolution by, you know, his acts of gallantry. He had this whole machismo warrior kind of thing going on too. And it was debatable how serious he was about all this. Like, I might have just been this weird fantasy kind of thing coming out. So, yeah, I couldn't even label him on any political spectrum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Maybe just nihilist, for lack of a better word. Like, just, I want to just overthrow everything.
He just wants it all to come down. We'll figure out what to do afterwards, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Interesting, too, I guess, that Jacques Blankfellow, his son, I saw he had a blog or something. Did you talk?
Yes. Yeah. I interviewed his son, Stanley. Rather obviously has been just affected for decades by this. You know, Stanley was 14 years old when his father was murdered, and it just shattered him. I mean, as understandable, and it was very intense interviewing him, you know, because he's still upset about this decades later, and just talked about the impact on his family, on his mom, as typical of a lot of families. 1964, his dad was the chief breadwinner, and he did get, there was a banking association that gave the family some money after the father was killed, but it wasn't a huge amount. And it was this sort of, this incredibly sad story. He gave me this incredibly sad story. The family lived near the bank that was robbed. So and the family that Friday, they were going to the bank to get money because they're supposed to go on holiday, and they were going to, Stanley's parents, Jack, and his mother, Sally, were going to open up a joint bank account for a holiday. They're going to take, like, I think it was like on Sunday or Monday. They go to the bank, and Stanley can hear these gunshots from his house or his apartment. And he said to me, he's just hoping to God that his father isn't involved in this, because he knows his dad. He knows his dad is military guy who thinks he's a warrior. And then Stanley's waiting and waiting and waiting. There's a knock on the door. And this voice says, "Hi, is that Stanley?" And he says, "Yeah." And then he said, "We've got your mother here. She's going to come up and talk to you." And he says it was two homicide detectives.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just like,
oh my.
He told me that. It's just like, man, This must have just been the most devastating thing imaginable. And then, of course, there's this debate after. Was his father a hero? Or was this really stupid to go after the heavily armed bank robber with a 38 caliber pistol?
Yeah, it must have been a really, especially in the early 60s like that, and he was only 14 or something, you said. Yeah, must have been a terrible time for him. You know,
absolutely.
So the parents are going to go in. That's interesting. How much research do you have? Do you do besides the direct information you're getting about the Beetle Bandit himself and a few others and stuff like with the guns behind the tillers and stuff like that?
Sure. There were two main things I did. Is like I said, Paul Truster provided me with court transcript, police memos, court documents, all that good stuff. So I did two things. I did the obvious, which is check out all the media articles from that era. So I got a good collection of those. Paul also had a few newspaper articles. But I also managed to interview a number of people directly involved in the case. I interviewed the Beetle Bandit's son, Kerry Jr. I interviewed Jack Blank's son, Stanley. I interviewed the accountant, Carmen Lamb, the guy who had the revolver. Who, by the way, I forgot to mention, he also, Carmen Lamb, went into the bank, got a second pistol, and shot a few rounds himself at the Beetle Bandit. I talked to him. I talked to two guys who were at the shooting, you know, who described to me in, you know, blow by blow. Okay, they see this guy running around, and next thing they know, there's a gunfight, and Jack Blank gets shot in the head. So I supplemented with some, I was very pleased with being able to reach these people, because the crime had taken place. It was a historic crime, but it wasn't so far back that all the witnesses and people involved were dead. So in 1964, there were still enough people alive who could talk to me directly. And that was, I felt pretty significant, because I felt, okay, I talked to people who were actually there in the bank when the Beetle Bandit showed up in this bizarro outfit and started shooting his rifle around, yelling at people and stuff.
When you do something like this and you go through it and you finish the book and someone picks it up and reads it, is there something you hope that they get out of it besides the actual story itself?
Yeah, I hope they get out of it. Well, a couple things. I hope they get out of it that one of the reasons I wrote this was that it triggered, bad choice of words, fueled major debate about, as I said, gun control, insanity defenses, death penalty. So it was the impetus for a lot of policy discussion, high-level debate in the Canadian government. The second thing I hope to get out of it is just the very human story of a tragedy of two families, Matthew Carey Smith's family, because they had to deal with the burden of, you know, him being this killer, and the Jack Blanks family, who, you know, were victimized by Smith. So I tried to humanize it like that as much as I could, and keep in mind that these are flesh and blood people, and show, you know, how this impacted people, you know, on a day-to-day level, and impacted just their entire lives, basically.
How does something like this affect you? Like when you write a book like this, and when you're through it and it's published now, do you look back and do you notice any change in yourself?
That's a very good question. The immediate thing that comes to mind, and I would, it's a very difficult balancing act between being compassionate and being objective, because I felt I did approach this in a compassionate way, you know, interviewing the survivors. But on the other hand, you do have to be fairly objective. So obviously I have great sympathy. Big part of me is like, okay, this is my latest book. This is the story. Here it is. And then, you know, it's one of several books I've written. Here are some of the other ones. That's not, you know, you obviously you can't be callous, because I think that's a big mistake for any true crime writer, but you do have to, you can't be so emotionally invested that every time I do a reading, I start weeping or something. And well, I've seen things like that happen. So it doesn't, I can't really say it changed me hugely, except on sort of certain, some technical things, like in terms of technical knowledge of how to do investigations in the future, or find, suss out certain documents and stuff. I've been journalist since the early 90s. You do kind of get used to it. And I'm trying really hard not to sound old, but you do kind of, it's part of the job. You have to get used to it, tell the story, and hope that you tell it in an as honest and compassionate form as possible.
I'd imagine when you go through a story like this, for myself anyway, I find this, there's always a couple of things that happen that are kind of not expected, in a way a surprise, or something you learn that you weren't sort of, you didn't think it would, you weren't thinking about it. It just comes out of the blue. Was there anything about this case that did that for you?
Yes, there was. A couple things, like a couple technical points. Just I had no idea that Canadian banks used to stock revolvers.
Yeah.
Expected staff to use them. And then what was really bizarre is that Paul also pointed out that this wasn't the first time something like this happened. Mm-hmm. There was another case in the 50s where a guy was robbing a bank and the manager grabbed a pistol and managed to shoot one of his own staff and killed him. So like this wasn't the first time a bizarre thing like this had happened. The second thing was some of the technical details. I discovered in the 1950s, Canada had a firearms registration, you know, which sounds okay, yeah, good Canadian. But they had this bizarre rule that all firearms had to be registered with the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But the law specifically defined a firearm to be a pistol, revolver, or a machine gun. And so bolt action rifles, shotguns, and semi-automatic rifles did not have to be registered. There was this bizarre loophole. And I had no idea that this existed. And I had no idea that this was a hugely controversial issue at the time, because there's a tendency of people tend to think a lot of issues are modern things. Like we think, oh, gun control, that's a contemporary concern, vigilantism, that's something we worry about now. But a lot of these stuff had happened like decades before. There were all these outraged newspaper articles, you know, tighten our gun laws, and you know, we should have a better registry, and all these sort of things. And I have to admit, even as a crime writer, I had no idea there was this level of debate more intensity, you know, years and years ago. So that was greatly surprising. So probably those two technical things, and the biggest overall things, just I have to reiterate, I did not know about this case before Paul Truster approached me, which any true crime writers listening, which is why it's a good idea to keep those lines of communication open. You never know when someone's going to give you a good tip or a good lead on a story.
I've had a number of them over the years. Just, you know, someone will reach out to me with something and just all of a sudden I'm down a rabbit hole that I didn't know existed. And it's like, exactly. How on earth did I not know about this? But, you know.
That's true. I can absolutely relate to that, Mike. And as you probably are fully aware, got to sort of have a filter to sift through some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I've had other, you know, people give me tips about stuff that is, you know, not exactly earth-shattering news. Yeah. And a guy wanted to expose corruption on some small town Ontario city council or something. And kind of had to politely tell him that, you know, that wasn't probably not, you know, something that most readers would be terribly interested in.
They paid $5,000 for a water cooler in the town hall.
we didn't even get that far. I was just like, okay, sure, pal.
Yeah. Well, okay, my grandpa is Jack the Ripper.
Everybody's grandpa is Jack the Ripper or H.H. Holmes.
Yeah.
Right,
so,
right.
Zodiac. Yeah, you know, it's crazy. I didn't know. Were women allowed to open a bank account in the 60s? In Canada?
Oh, geez. Man.
Because in America, they weren't. It was not until they had to have a husband's signature starting in 64. And then in 74, they said, okay, we'll let you have your own bank account.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I was just shocked, you know.
I'm not 100% sure. I would suspect the laws were similar. And, of course, it's different if you're a single woman.
Well, of course.
Versus a married woman.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have to plead ignorance. I don't know what the situation was. I do know the Beatle Bandit got his girlfriend to open a bank account because he was sort of laundering bank proceeds from his bank heists. He got his girlfriend and some of his buddies to open bank accounts and he would put money in. But I don't know the exact deets. If she had to get his signature or anything.
I think that's the most interesting thing about when you do, you know, especially researching older stories like that, older crimes, and finding out a lot of the information. And it's true, like you said, every time I go through, even the recent one from the 20s that I was writing about, it seems like when you go through the newspapers, they're arguing the same things that we hear now.
Yeah.
It's just different names and different places, but it's the same arguments, you know, like you said about guns or militia or, you know, politics of some sort or some sort of, it's the same sort of battles. And I'm always fascinated by it.
I do have a little bit of a theory about that. It's one reason why true crime is such a popular genre is because when you do historic true crime, you know, everybody wants to read about, you know, there's been a million books on Jack Ripper, right? Mm-hmm. But very, very few people would want to read a book about 1880s British House of Commons debate about wheat imports or something.
Need a nap.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, I'm sure it was a big issue at the time. Like there's a lot of, when you do these newspaper research about old crimes, they'll have a big headline about something like, you know, inquiry at, you know, motor vehicle licensing firm reveals corruption big issue at the time, big issue for a few people. But nowadays, most people would yawn and go, oh, whatever. So, but, you know, unfortunately, we're still fascinated by certain murders or scams. You know, a lot of the stuff is with us since time immemorial.
Yeah. No, it just, the things actually stay the same in a way.
We
keep replaying it, you know. At the end of the day, how did it end up? So obviously the Beatle Bandit, Smith, didn't get put to death. What ended up happening with this man?
Well, a bit of a tragedy. He gets commuted which means his sentence is changed from a hanging to life in prison. And he's shipped off to Kingston Penitentiary, which any Canadian listener know, it's a fairly tough prison in the Canadian system. And he seems to settle in for a while. He's writing all these letters to his girlfriend, which, again, the Paul Truster provided me with copies of some of these letters, and I got permission from the family to use them. And the letters are fascinating because, you know, quite often half of them are just day-to-day stuff, like went to the commissary and got a coffee, blah, blah, blah. And then he'll sometimes go off in these weird tangents about just bizarre stuff, about having a relative who was a weightlifter and who could beat up anybody and all this sort of weird stuff. So he seems relatively upbeat. And then in the summer of 1966, the Beatle Manic commits suicide in jail. He slashes his wrists with a razor. Turns out that he was not put in the psychiatric wing of the prison, because the prison governor thought he'd have more, he'd enjoy himself more than not in their general population. Prisoners in general pop got, you know, razors to use to shave themselves. Psychiatric prisoners did not. And he used one of the blades to cut his wrists open, and he died. And he didn't leave any behind any kind of suicide note, give any real indication of why he did this. His son, Kerry Jr., had a theory that he might have just been overwhelmed with guilt about killing Jack Blank. Mm-hmm. Because if newspaper accounts are to be believed, the Beatle Bandit did have a change of heart at the end of his life. That he regretted robbing banks, regretted committing murder, gave up the idea of revolution, and was very remorseful. And to me, I put that in the book, and I didn't say this is the definitive reason, but I said it's, to me, as good a reason as any.
Sure.
Because he didn't leave behind any real message of why he did this.
With the letters that you have of his, could you tell, did you get any sort of sense of if he was actually remorseful, or if he even thought about it, or did he write about it? Did he...
In his letters, he never, the letters I have, and keep in mind, I don't necessarily have all of them, he didn't really mention anything about the crime. And he almost casually mentioned that, by the way, my lawyer's appealing my case to the Supreme Court, maybe I'll get hanged. And then the next sentence would be something about, getting new boot laces for shoes or something. So he didn't really talk at all about the case in the letters I have. A lot of his letters were just simply talking about his family, because he had kids at the time. He had his girlfriend, Eileen, had her own daughter from a previous marriage, and their son, Kerry Jr. So he would talk, give advice about kids and say, you know, kids are well and blah, blah, blah. And he'd talk little trivia about what he was doing in prison. He was working in a wood shop, playing guitar. So the letters are like weirdly sort of, they're not, if you're looking for deep insights on this guy's personality, they definitely were not there. Although, like I said, occasionally he'd go off in these very odd tangents about strange things, which I suspect was a sign of his mental illness. But if you read the letters, you'd probably have no idea this guy was a convicted
murderer. It's really,
you might think.
Yeah. Strange. Strange. Now, how do you like to have your readers get in touch with you? Do you do social media? Do you have a website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a website, and they're welcome to go to there. It's www.natehendley.com, NateHendley.com. The website has information about all of my books, about my background, about presentations I'm doing. So I have been doing some presentations. COVID hasn't been very kind with doing in-person presentations, but I'm doing a few online things. And it has my contact information on the site. So if you're interested in the book or in contacting me, go to my website, natehendley.com, check out my stuff, and my email and everything is there. I'm also on, like, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn and all that good stuff, and Instagram.
Moving up, TikTok next.
Oh boy.
Yeah, no, I haven't done any TikToks. I think I'm a little beyond the generational demographic. But wants to see me dance and, you know, and
well, you
doing
know,
my thing. So
yeah,
that's well, true. It's true.
Well, we'll have that on the website, of course, so people can find you with one
right,
click and everything like that. How was the COVID during your writing here? Did you sort of, you must have done a
oh,
lot of
yeah.
it. Yeah. Was it affected? Did it really affect?
Oh, it, yes, actually. COVID had a massive impact on the book because it made gathering photographs just brutally difficult because part of my contract is I had to gather up pictures for the book. And Paul Truster gave me a few photos that we ended up using, but a lot of the pictures I wanted were from archives. And all of the archives in Toronto were closed because of COVID. So the only photos they would make available were stuff that they had digitized, like pictures from, you know, the newspapers in the 60s that were in digital format. And that's only like a tiny percentage of all their pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just brutal, like trying to get these photos and find stuff. So that's one reason, in case anyone's wondering, I think there's a total of 8 or 9 pictures in the book. And, you know, something like this, you might have typically have more like 20. But it's like, I did my best, folks. And it was really brutal getting photographs. So that definitely had a huge impact. So I couldn't just go down to, there's like the Toronto Archives, Ontario Archives, Library, Archives Canada, all these places you could typically, normal times you could go in person, do a search, come up with some photos, la-di-da, it's great, but you couldn't do that. So everything had to be done online. And like I said, most of these archives have only digitized a tiny percentage of their pictures.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for the ones I had. COVID definitely made things very tough.
Do you find that you get affected by things going on around you too? So like, you know, with the COVID and the stress and the lockdown and all the weird stuff you see on the news.
COVID didn't really affect me personally because I've been working at home for like 20 years. I work as a journalist, freelance journalist. So that didn't impact me. Closing the gyms, swimming pools, was horrid because it took away a lot of my exercise outlets. What was more hard to say? Yeah, it's a good question because the one thing is like, from Monday to Friday, I'm usually doing like freelance journalism, like business, trade magazine stories about bulldozers and GPS satellites on wheel loaders. And it kind of distracts you in a way, and it's good because it keeps you like, you got to just sort of cut out time for your book and just say, okay, Saturday, I'm going to write for 6 hours, then spend a couple hours researching and blah, blah, blah. You can't be precious about it and say, well, I'm only going to write when the muse strikes my brow and the angels come down and kiss my forehead with inspiration. You can't do that. Like, because I'm busy, you know, I got a deadline. I got to get this thing done. So on a personal level, COVID definitely affected me. And for research and photos, it affected me. But otherwise, no real massive change.
Interesting. Well, another great conversation with another great author. The book we're talking about is The Beetle Bandit. And our guest is the author, Nate Hentley. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Alan and Mike. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoy doing the show. And I'm going to give a plug to Mike's book because I just read it and gosh darn, it was darn good. It kept my interest.
Oh, thanks, Nate. I appreciate that. I've been thinking the whole time here, I want to have you on my show to talk about this book that you just wrote. So,
okay. Well, yeah. I'm always happy to do interviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.